We discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Marcus Blankenship. Marcus helps great coders become great managers. Welcome, Marcus.
Thanks for having me on, Jen.
Yeah, no problem. I am super excited to talk with you, Marcus, about the stuff that you're working on. And so let's get started with what does it mean to help great coders become great managers? So I'm curious a little bit about how it is that you help folks, but also a little bit about your backstory and why you decided to do this and what led to it.
Sure. Well, I think to me, what it means is helping people who have invested many years in learning one set of skills, and that's the coding side of things, take the next step in their career to be able to be really good at management and people leadership of other developers. And that's really important because it's a very different kind of work. Mm-hmm. You probably know this, but, you know, it's a hard transition to make, which kind of goes to the backstory, I guess. Mm-hmm. When I was first promoted from being a software engineer, a senior software engineer, to a team lead, my boss told me, well, you'll code about 75% of the time and manage about 25% of the time, and so it won't be that big a deal. It's sort of like a programmer plus. That mm-hmm. Was sort of the analogy. Like, you're a programmer, you're just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And the expectation was that I could come into the office, spend roughly 5 or 6 hours a day coding, and I still had a team of six. Well, and I was given a team of six. And so I was expected to kind of manage them in my spare time. I quickly became overwhelmed. I started hiding in my office when there were problems. I felt like the code was that my safe place, my happy place, was the code, and everything else was not work that I really enjoyed. And yet, it didn't take long before things kind of started to fall apart, as you might expect. Mm-hmm. I got behind on my management work, wasn't doing code reviews as often as I should or as thoroughly as I should. I started skipping my one-on-one meetings, and my team started getting the impression that I was kind of an absent boss.
Yeah.
And I think they started noticing, to be honest, that I didn't really want to do this management thing. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted to do was just code, because that's all I did. That led to a series of, I guess you'd call them, unfortunate events, which forced me to take stock of what I was doing and the kind of work that I really needed to do and decide that being a manager, and I wasn't thinking I was a leader at the time, just a little team lead, mm-hmm. was actually the kind of work I'd better figure out how to do that. Yeah. I'd better figure out what it means to be a team lead or lead some people. There was just a lot at stake. And mm-hmm. I realized that my team was a super expensive resource. Like, if you added up everybody's salary per hour, it was way more than mine. So I found the transition to be really difficult, and as I grew with the company and continued to, as I really started to embrace what it meant to be a manager and a technical leader, I remember watching this vicious cycle over and over again, where the company would promote someone, and then that person would flail around for months or years, mm-hmm. and sometimes they failed. And by failure, maybe they left the company, or maybe they actually went back down to being an individual contributor. And that's not inherently a failure, but they certainly felt like a failure.
Right.
So I guess my backstory is, in the last 3 years, I've really decided that I want to make the world of work better for great engineers who decide to take the step into management, mm-hmm. and I want to give them a much smoother transition than I had.
Got it. And how has that been? Have you been enjoying yourself? Do you feel like you've been helping people?
I think so. I love it. You know, when I started, so I had a services agency for about 7 years, And it shut down 3 years ago when the partnership failed. And that was also a painful experience we could talk about on another episode if you want. But the reality is that I reached out to my network of other agency owners, and I basically just offered to help them. I said, if you guys want to talk about anything in your business, I will help you not make the same mistakes I did. There was no money involved. It was just me being nice and trying to kind of process what had happened. But I found that as these other owners of, and we're talking small companies, under 20 people, would come in, they were oftentimes really frustrated with their team. And they were mostly engineering teams with a little bit of design or copywriting, but mostly engineers. And I would hear things from the owners like, boy, if I want something done right, I just have to do it myself. Or nobody gets it. Nobody else here at the company gets it. I can't just hand a task to somebody and they'll run with it. And when I would ask them things like, well, if we rank your people, do you have some poor performers? Like, who do you wish you could get rid of? Oh, yeah, these two people. I just wish I'd never hired them. But then asking him, what do you do about that? What are you going to do about it was a whole other proposition, because all they saw was problems. They didn't have tools to really correct things. So I started to realize that there might be a more formalized way, a business, if you would be, of helping people, whether they were an accidental manager and sort of just stumbled into it because they owned the company, or they had gotten promoted and they were feeling pretty lost. There were tools I could help people with to be able to manage their teams.
When you think about the folks that you've been helping, whether they're the accidental managers or they're the engineers, the coders who then get promoted to become managers, what would you say is the number one piece of advice that you give people?
You know, the number one thing I tell people is, first I tell them it's a very different kind of work, and they nod and they say, yeah, we know that. Great. And then I tell them the way it's different is that they now are sitting in this super important role that they didn't ever really consider to be quite as important as it is.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in relationship theories of management. And that states, for example, like leader member exchange theory, as I'm sure you're well aware, talks about the importance of the leader's role and the relationship the leader has with their team members and the direct impact of job performance and job satisfaction. Now, I'm a novice, you know, psychology student, as I'm 47 years old, having gone back to school. But the more I see these kinds of things, the more I realize that the people who are managing programmers oftentimes put too much emphasis on the tasks, the task activities in their job. Maybe it is coding, but oftentimes, even if it's not coding, it could be worrying about process, worrying about servers, worrying about architecture, thinking about Agile. And what they don't do is they don't put as much time as necessary on the relationship behaviors. So, kind of coming full circle, one of the first pieces of advice I give them is they need to have a weekly one-on-one with every person on their team consistently and regularly, because that becomes the primary communication channel where all kinds of wonderful things are going to happen.
And so, speaking of one-on-ones, if there was a book, like a 101 book, 101 one-on-ones, a one-on-one book for, say, new tech managers, I think that having those one-on-ones, having those one-on-one meetings would definitely be part of it, because you hear so many people giving that advice. But it's not just because we're just sort of like pulling it out of thin air, it's because it actually works. And one of the things to delve a little bit deeper into one-on-ones, one of the things that I've heard folks say, and one of the things that I've experienced myself when I was managing teams, is that especially if your team is larger, if it's, you know, 5, 6 and then 10 and then more than that, one-on-ones can take up a lot of time just because of the pure math, you know, 30 minutes times 5 people times 10 people. So what would you say, Marcus, to the person who says, oh yeah, you know what, I get that it's important to have that one-on-one FaceTime, but they take up so much time over the course of my week. Wouldn't my time be better spent doing other stuff?
Well, first, I'd acknowledge that they absolutely do take a lot of time. And I often find 30 minutes can feel like you're rushing through it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's pretend we do have 10 people at 30 minutes. That's 5 hours. That's over 10% of your week on a normal 40-hour week.
That's right.
So let's just call a spade and acknowledge this is a big time investment. But I think your second question is really where things get interesting. And that is, wouldn't my time be better spent somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to say no. I don't think it would be spent somewhere else. And because when I look at the range of activities that someone could do with that 5 hours, like if we think about it, they could be planning work, mm-hmm. very important to plan work, right? They could be meeting with their boss and their customer. Yep, that's important.
Mm-hmm.
They could be evaluating technologies. Maybe that's important. But at the end of the day, what they need to learn is oftentimes to delegate their decisions. Because every technical leader I know wishes they had a team that took more responsibility for their work, had better context about their work, made better decisions about their work, and really was able to run ahead in a positive, meaningful, constructive way,
mm-hmm.
instead of having the team lead feel like they're, I hear, like pulling them along by the nose.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you get any of those good, that return on investment until you make the investment of a regular, consistent one-on-one meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you know, Jen, you have to get to know everybody individually.
Mm-hmm.
There's no like kind of aggregate person on your team where you say, oh, my team is introverted and my team has these attributes. No, they're not all just like clones of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they all care about different things. They all have different strengths, right?
Yep.
And as a manager, and they really need that private time where they learn to trust you.
Yeah.
And because at the end of the day,
yep.
I think the trust is what you trade on every time you go to delegate. You're trading on the relationship.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I've experienced this, how it can go wrong when you don't do it, when you don't do the one-on-ones. At one point, my team was about 15 people total. And I just decided, you know what, I for whatever reason, and I was tired and I was just frustrated and I wanted to be spending my time on other things. So I said, yeah, you know what, we're not going to do the one-on-ones anymore. What we're going to do is we're just going to meet as a group and everybody can just sort of talk in the group. So we would all meet. And I think it was a 2-hour meeting that I did. But then what I found, which isn't surprising in retrospect, is that you get the people who are more extroverted, who are more talkative. They were the ones who were talking more during the meeting, and that other folks were not, their voices were not being heard. And then as soon as I switched back to doing the one-on-ones, even though it took more time, I realized that I was neglecting the quieter people who had absolutely awesome ideas. And I was actually bias in like my performance ratings of them, because like, oh yeah, this person, you know, Julie doesn't talk during the meeting, so therefore she mustn't be doing really good. But you know what, it happened that Julie was actually really awesome. The only way I was able to find that out in the way that Julie ticks was through the one-on-ones.
Yeah, Jen, I found the same thing, that when somebody didn't speak up in a meeting, it was really easy to categorize them as not having a lot of initiative, not being a star performer, right? I definitely would view the people who were sitting forward, leaning in the meeting as the people who were really contributing.
Mm-hmm.
But that did not mean that they were really contributing the same, like better contributors in the work of software development.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is, I actually tried that too, is I was overwhelmed managing about 10, and I said, we'll just do a weekly status meeting or a weekly team meeting, I called it.
Yeah.
And I found that what that was really a meeting for me. That was a meeting for me to get information, much more than it was a meeting for them.
Yeah.
Of course, the extroverts thought it was great, and it's a great use of time. And the introverts they just kind of, well, they didn't just sit there, but they would give me a status report in the meeting, which was framed in terms of let's all work together. And what that meant in a really kind of an immature way was if we all just say what we're doing, that somehow we're working together, which is not mm-hmm. the same thing. And I found team meetings oftentimes were meant like they ended up serving me, but they didn't at all serve them. And they weren't a trust builder or a relationship building activity.
Yeah.
What I tell people now, though, because we have to be practical, there's no point in pretending and beating anybody up that they're not getting all of their one-on-ones in, is I tell people that consistency is more important than frequency. Mm-hmm. If you have 10 people, I would rather see you start meeting with people every other week.
Yep.
And spread that load across 2 weeks rather than scheduling one-on-ones weekly and then canceling them.
Yes.
Because frankly, canceling a one-on-one is a broken promise. Mm-hmm. And I know people say I'm ridiculous. That's fine. But the reality is if you schedule a meeting with me and then you don't come, or if you reschedule it, it sure smells like a broken promise. Mm-hmm. And that's where the relationship starts to break down.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, and especially as it starts happening more than once, as it becomes a pattern, once you might just say, oh, you know, life happens, she's sick, or he had a family emergency, and that's fine. And it can go either way, whether it's the manager who cancels it, or whether it's the team member who cancels it. But once it starts to happen more than that, then it starts to get a little more, as you said, the trust begins to break down more. And, you know, and you're not yeah. talking about it. So therefore, that makes it break down even faster. So yeah, your point's very
That's
well taken.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
One of my clients describes it, when we first started working, and I said, well, tell me about your one-on-one practice. He said, oh, I plan them for Monday, and then I chase them across my calendar week. I just keep moving them every day, and usually end up doing them Thursdays and Fridays. But every week, they all start out on Monday. And I thought, man, that team must kind of live in chaos. Like on any given moment, your boss might call and say, oh, let's do our one-on-one in 15 minutes because I finally have time.
Yeah.
Sure sends the signal that the manager's time is so much more important than the subordinate's time,
yeah.
right? The subordinates yeah. can't really plan their week or their work because at any given moment, that one-on-one might be canceled, and so therefore it might be moved.
Yep.
And frankly, this is the other thing I found. If your boss lives in such chaos that he can't even control his calendar,
yeah.
how much can he really protect you? And I found programmers have told me, like, it makes me nervous that my boss is at the whim of everyone else in the company, as evidenced by his calendar is always moving.
Yeah.
And that makes me nervous about how much I can really trust that he can protect the team.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I think it's so important for managers or anybody who's in a leadership position, whatever the job title, to make sure that you're communicating that it's an open door, that I'm here for you, that I'm on top of stuff. And then if you want to come in and quote unquote interrupt me, that's fine. I can't tell how many times that like somebody would come into my office and be like, oh, no, you're busy, aren't you? And not that I looked busy. I'm not the kind of person that usually looks busy. I usually look pretty put together. At least that's what most people say. But my team members, I think it's most because of the power thing that it's like, oh, you're my boss, so you must be busy. But no, come in. Like, no, but I don't want to stay away, keep you away from what it is you're doing. I don't want to keep you away from your job. And I'd say, no, this is my job. Come in. Let's talk. Do you have something that you want to talk about? And so that's why I love the idea of having like from time to time, in addition to the one-on-ones, whether it's every week or every 2 weeks, I love that suggestion, is to have office hours. Maybe it's once a week for a couple hours. And just say, really, open door policy. I may be working on other stuff. I may be typing away, checking my email, whatever. But please come in. Whatever it is you're dealing with is going to be far more important, whatever it is I'm doing at that point. So please come in and talk. So I like the idea of adding that to like office hours, borrowing from the academic world a bit. But I think it is one of the practices that can do good and really help folks in other environments as well.
I like that a lot. I'm going to steal that. And, you know, since we're talking about open door policies, one of the things that I'm just going to kind of hit on this. I do hear managers who are really busy sometimes use this defense. Mm-hmm. They will say to me, well, Marcus, I have an open door policy. People can walk in anytime they want and talk to me. And I don't think that works. And my biggest problem is that when, and I read an article and I spoke and interviewed Elizabeth Brace Souders, who did an article for HBR on why canceling your one-on-ones actually makes your time, makes it harder to manage your time. And her assertion was this: when when all you have is an open door policy, you're really treating yourself and your work as though you were some sort of manager help desk, as though you were sitting by a manager phone waiting for it to ring like a call center. And at any moment, the phone could ring and you'd jump into action. You'd pick up the phone and you'd say, manager here, how can I help you? Right? Uh-huh. Like as if you called your cable company's help desk. Mm-hmm. And her assertion was, you know, that is a really terrible way to structure your management time. As a manager, you do have times where you need to sort of really concentrate, right? Whether you are still coding or you're planning or you're thinking about anything, we need those times. And I think I like the reason about your office because people are still hesitant to actually knock on the door because they do think they're bothering you.
Yeah.
So you can say, I have an open door policy, but A, if you're never in your office,
yeah.
B, if it's constantly interrupting you, pretty quickly they're going to notice that you seem a little irritated when they use your open door policy, and then I don't think they'll use it again.
Right. Yeah. So I think that that's something to keep in mind, that maybe it means that open door policies aren't for everyone, that if you're the kind of person who you're that when you're checking email, no matter what it is, even if it's the smallest level tasks, that you need complete focus on that. And that if somebody were to knock on your door, that would just totally get you out of flow and irritate you a little bit, then maybe it's not for you. So I think that's a really good point. I like the manager help desk analogy. That is absolutely not what we're going for. it's the opposite
right.
of what we're going
yep.
for.
Exactly.
Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. Yeah. So Marcus, you had mentioned something before that I want to touch on a little bit because we have time, that you're a student, you're a psychology student. And because I know that at least some of my guests are also fellow psychology students, I wanted to just talk a little bit about that and how that sort of affects your thinking and our thinking around leadership and management and that kind of thing. So first, I'll just start very generally. How have you found being a psychology student? Is it enlightening? Is it like, oh, this is all the stuff that I knew already? Is it fun? Is it stressful? How has the experience been so far?
Well, I'll be candid. At first, I went into it thinking, well, I've been a leader and a manager for many, many years now. This is going to be like sailing through the a lot of the classes. And darn it, it's not. And for example, I am now in my, I'm very new going back to school. I'm going to Penn State and I'm now in my first leadership class as a part of the psychology program. Mm-hmm. And I find it so useful because it frames activities, behaviors, priorities. It frames things in a way that I can then help my clients see through a different frame.
Yep.
Now, I'm just beginning through this. So I actually don't try and, you know, present myself to my clients as though I'm an expert, as you are. But what I find is whether we're talking just about strength-based leadership or we're talking about, You know, as I mentioned earlier, this idea of we have past behaviors and relationship behaviors. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a little older, I'm 47, and I've done this for a while. So for me, it lets me fit it into a frame of context with all the years of experience I have. Mm-hmm. I honestly wish I had done this many, many years ago, but it really helps me, I think, communicate better and sort of find, I guess, help my clients see their own work better. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, and I'm sure that you as an IO psychologist have used lots of assessments, but I'm seeing in from new eyes the value of self-assessments and team assessments in terms of personality traits, communication styles, leadership styles, strengths. And all of those are just continuing, I guess, to be tools in my novice psychology tool belt that I use to help my clients.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. Yeah. Yeah, and the assessments thing actually reminded me that sometimes, not as much anymore, but because I think IO psychology is becoming more, a little bit more mainstream, not completely, but people know more about it. At least they get it more. But I found myself, especially in the earlier years, like, reminding people that, yes, psychology is a science, and so IO psychology is a science as well. And so part of that means collecting data, again, doing assessments. I still remember in grad school, so this was when I was in grad school, and there were a bunch of psych programs. You know, so there was the IO psych program, but then there was also social psych, clinical psych, biopsych, and I think it was a biopsych grad student who came up to me. You know, biopsych, extremely science, much more hard science than say IO psych is. And she came, Oh, you're an IO psych. Oh, that's really cool. So she just had this look on her face, like, what do you do exactly? It must be like a lot of theory. And I looked at her and said, yeah, there is a lot of theory, but we collect data as well. Oh, really? You do? So I think that it's worth reminding folks about that piece of it, that that whatever way you can assess, even if it's with small data, big data is, you know, all the rage, right? It may be falling off the wayside a little bit, but even if it's with a little bit of data, even if it's with a self-assessment or some sort of team assessment, whether it's performance or something else, whether it's attitudes or behaviors, that data, as long as you remember the caveats of not having a lot of data, which means you can't generalize it beyond, and that there may not necessarily be trends there, but that you can take a look at it and say, you know, this is really interesting. So yeah, the assessment piece of it is huge. And yes, the framing stuff, I think, especially in leadership psych, there's lots of theories that everybody has their own leadership theory. And so you can delve deep into one, or what I like to do is just sort of take them all in moderation and be like, oh, you know what, there's these 10, 20, whatever number of leadership theories, and look at the frameworks of all of them, and how can I kind of put them together to figure out what the commonalities are, and then apply that to the real world. So it sounds like you've been starting to do that a little bit already, Marcus, you know, in terms of like looking at it as a frame, which is exactly what I do.
Excuse me. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. There are so many leadership theories, and they really vary from, you know, like we have early great man leadership theories through a lot of more relational, through all kinds of things. And I think in my mind, the part that's interesting is that we're still exploring it. And I think the thing I try and tell leaders, technical leaders, is the fact that there's so many reminds us that it is an imperfect science. And while it is science, we're still, as a group of people, trying to figure out how do we motivate? What motivates? What matters? This idea that relationship matters is actually a pretty new, I understand it's kind of a new concept. Mm-hmm. And yet my guess is if we kind of went back in history to leaders 100 years ago and 500 years ago, mm-hmm. there was an element that relationship mattered. Yep. We just didn't know about it, or we didn't look at it from that perspective.
Right.
And so I find the relationship part of it, to be honest, to be, and I don't want to delve into this too much, but the reason I teach from that perspective is this. I kind of don't like the idea that leaders are born, not made, because I think it excludes me and a lot of other people mm-hmm. from, quote unquote, being a natural leader. And so when I talk to technical people, technical leaders, they're oftentimes introverts. They never really wanted to lead anything in their life. Mm-hmm. And what I try and tell them, what I tell them is this: you already have all the skills it takes to create great relationships. Yeah. Right? You do it with your family, your spouse, your friends. You know how to do those things. What you have to do is learn to take those skills and apply them in a work setting. And I promise you, if you do that, you're going to get that great relationships at work, which are really going to have a positive impact on your team's productivity and their happiness and all of this other stuff. And so what I guess that's my perspective, is it is something that's a skill that can be learned, mm-hmm. and it's something that we all are kind of wired for relationship anyway. So it's not out of reach of any of us.
Yeah. And I absolutely agree. And yeah, I love that. I love that perspective. I love that way of looking at it. It's very uplifting. It's powerful. Yes, I can do this. I just need to learn how to apply it in a different context. So speaking of tasks versus relationships, you had mentioned earlier, Marcus, about they may be coding. You know, managers may still be doing some coding. So that would fall under something that would be more task-oriented rather than relationship-oriented. So I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about coding, managers, tech managers who code. So in your mind, on the tech manager's priority list, where should coding fall?
You know what? I think it needs to fall towards the bottom. And this is really depressing because I love to code. Every tech manager I know got into technology business because they love to do the software development work. That's the part that they enjoyed. But I think the reality is their position. If you're leading a team of five engineers, there's an awful lot on that team that only you can do. And when you're coding, you are not doing the unique work that only you can do. And that work includes managing your boss or your client, having a lot of upward conversations. It includes having a lot of outward conversations, peers, other departments, coordinating with other kinds of groups in the company, or even vendors outside the company. Mm-hmm. If you own the company, it includes a whole raft of things you need just to keep the company afloat, like your accounting, your bookkeeping, your sales, your marketing, all kinds of junk that aren't engineering. And so, but the engineering is what we know the best, right? We get into it and we say, well, I'm a coder and now I'm going to do a little light management. But the reality is there's so many things that no one else can do. I find that if you're spending significant time coding, you're probably ignoring one of those special things that you can't offload to anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the second thing that I wanted to ask related to this, and I asked this from personal experience, and also because I've heard of this happening before. So sometimes what happens, I think, is that a tech manager, like say a software engineering manager, knows that he or she should probably be spending less of his or her time coding and more time strategizing, relationship building, you know, things like that. But that they're feeling pressure from above. They're feeling pressure, say, from their boss, who might be, say, a VP or CTO, who thinks that they actually should be spending more time coding. That in that person's mind, in that VP's mind, in that CTO's mind, that the manager that the manager actually should be coding more. So I'm wondering how you might respond to that, or how you might help the tech manager sort of wriggle their way through that kind of difficult situation where their boss thinks that they should be coding.
Now, I think that's a great question. It's completely common. And I think this even started when I described my backstory a little bit, as I was told, well, you're going to be coding 75% mm-hmm. and managing 25%. So it was a similar situation. My boss said, you're a senior programmer, like, and we're going to make you a team lead, but we still need your senior programmer contribution to the team. And that's exactly what I tried to do. And that's exactly where I started to really fall down. Yeah. You could imagine, and maybe people who are listening to this might find the same thing, that your coding projects, are oftentimes the ones that are starting to come in late, because the work of management happens during the day with your team, so your coding happens at night.
Yeah.
And no one's great at night, and that means from the hours of 5 to 10 p.m., you're ignoring your family. This is what I did. So I would stay late 2 to 3 nights a week, and I would say, well, this is my coding time.
Yeah.
And at first, I loved it. Quiet time, but the reality is I also noticed I was tired. So bugs started creeping in. Mm-hmm. That meant my quality went down. Mm-hmm. So, and I noticed that as the months went by, I found a trend where my coding work was like the whole team would take stories, and a lot of people would get done and be like, great, we're going to have a great sprint. Marcus, why are you lagging behind us?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I was always the one kind of pulling up the rear, turning in my work at the 11th hour, saying, yeah, I'm going to stay late tonight and get to it, all this other stuff. So finally, I went to my boss and I said, I would like to try an experiment. And this is maybe something that your listeners can do. I'd like to try an experiment where for 3 months, I don't contribute any production code.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my boss was like, well, that's not the job. And I said, no, hold it. The job you gave me is to make sure that this team, of which I am a unit, produces the amount of software needed in this time frame. And he's like, yeah, that's the job, and we'll need you to continue coding in order to do it. And I said, well, this is where I think an experiment could be done. What if I don't code for 3 months? I will bet you that we produce the same amount of software or more
mm-hmm.
if I spend that time coaching, writing specs, clearly kind of outlining the technical details that only I have in my head because I've been here 10 years, and putting that into the team's head, I'll bet you that this team will more than make up the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, it won't work. But I trust you, 3 months, feel free, we'll talk in 3 months, and then you can go back to coding.
Okay.
I was like, okay. So that's exactly what I did. I started really spending a lot of time with my team, pair programming. My quality of requirements went way up because instead of just writing them in a cursory way, thinking, oh, I know what this means, I'll take this task, I thought, well, I better really outline what needs to happen and all the acceptance criteria. So and then I need to do a warm handoff with the engineer I'm going to give this to, and then I'm going to sit with them and make sure they really understand it. Well, after 3 months, we had more than exceeded the output mm-hmm. that we had even when I was coding. And my team started to really, I guess, spread their wings. They understood more yeah. about the system. I was more relaxed because I was still doing a little coding, but only tools and prototypes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where that distinction came in. I could still exercise my engineering brain, but I took myself out of the production development cycle.
Yep.
And that was really key for me.
Yeah.
And that meant that all my weird deadlines, like where I had to be there from 5 p.m. to midnight,
yeah.
The day before the release, went away because I was not coding anything that went into the release.
Yeah.
And basically, I went back to my boss after 3 months and I showed him the numbers. And by the way, our numbers were things like we knew how many projects released, store points, yeah. business value, and we had done way more than we had in the past. 3 months, we'd done a lot better. And I said, so this looks good to me. Let's do another experiment and try it for 3 more months. And it wasn't long before other team leads literally walked in my office and they said, why do you go home at 5? Why aren't you here in the evenings? And I was like, well, let me tell you, I'm trying this experiment. And so kind of infected other people in the department who thought, that's seems like maybe a saner route. And it worked out pretty well.
That's great. That's an awesome story. I love that story. There's some great take-home points there. And I love how in the conversation with your boss, that part of the message was, let's help them spread their wings. Let let's see what they can do. Let's challenge them because I know that they're capable of way more than they are now. And that actually the way to do that, to let them spread their wings, is for me to step back a little bit, to still be there to provide guidance, to be able to do that and to mentor them. But let's see what happens. And it's sort of, it's almost like a dare, you know, it's like, okay, let's jump and see what happens. And, but I like how you framed it as an experiment as well, that, you know, hey, if it fails, which it might be, going back to how it was before. That's great.
Yeah, and you know, I'll be honest, like by the end of the 3 months, this is a little hard to admit. I wish I could tell you that I was walking around feeling great. But the honest truth was I was really struggling with an identity crisis because up until that point, I was a programmer plus plus. And over that 3 months, I had turned into a manager.
Yeah.
And the only real cultural icon of a tech manager I had was the pointy-haired boss from Dilbert. And that's not a very positive role model.
No, it's not.
So I started to get really concerned that my tech skills are going to erode and I'm not going to understand the system well enough to really guide my team. And who am I anyway? Like, am I going to have to use hair gel and wear matching socks and buy Dockers, right? Am I going to have to change this big, a lot about myself because I'm not a coder anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out I didn't. I still don't use hair gel, thankfully. But the reality is that it was a tough identity crisis, like, for me to go through because I started coding when I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And since I was 12 up until the point I was 30, I only wanted to be a software engineer, and that's what I went to school to do, and that's what I was good at. And it's just like a recent one of my coaching clients who got to move into his first vice president of engineering role.
Yeah.
He called me and he said, "I'm not prepared for this. I spent 25 years working on coding skills. I have no idea what I'm doing." And so I just kind of want to throw out there that when you take this leap, this transition, it might feel kind of awkward. And you might even be jealous of all the cool stuff your team is doing because they're getting to do it. Yeah. But the reality is your job is to build a team that does the work and make sure that they have what they need. So you have to step back, check your own ego, and say, like, what's best for the team and the company? And go build them great tools. Just don't be a part of the production process.
Yeah. Excellent point. Excellent points all around. So the last question that I have for you, Marcus, is a question that I ask all of my guests on the podcast. And the question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Well, since my job is now helping technical leaders, I would have said something different if I was managing a team. But right now, I would say the biggest challenge, that's a good question. The biggest challenge is probably helping people safely see the work they need to do and not feel shame and humiliation because they haven't been a good manager. I have a lot of people, technical leaders, who the first statement they say in our onboarding call is they say, "I'm not a good manager and I'll never be. So we just, like, you just have to know that about me." And I feel like that comes from a place that's kind of sad, where they have evaluated their own work and themselves, and they've just decided they're not a good manager. And somehow they've gotten in their head that they're not capable of that. So it can be a little hard to wrestle that belief from somebody. And I find that doing it by starting with just skill building, let's do one-on-one. It's really simple. You don't even have to be great at it. And you'll see that you can start seeing some of these relationship benefits. Let's start, you know. So I basically try and show them if they'll just, I guess it's kind of like an athletic trainer. If you just lift these weights, you may not be a strong person, but you'll be stronger in 3 months if you do this consistently.
Yep. I think that's a great approach. And I think in some ways I take a very similar approach, that for folks who enroll in my program, that it starts out very small. just like the gym metaphor, you're not going to walk in and on the first day, they're not going to have you, deadlift 100 pounds, right? It starts out really small and it can almost feel like too easy, but like, okay, right. You're excited about this. Great. You're excited about, you want more. All right. But let's stay focused here and let's not do too much at once. And that if you do commit to it and doing these smaller things, like I start with one-on-ones, because that's something that everybody should be doing anyway. And so let's start there. It's something that you're doing multiple times a week anyway. So let's talk about how we can make those better. And then you sort of build from there and you scaffold from there. So I think that's a pretty good approach that has worked for me as well. And I absolutely appreciate what you're saying, Marcus, in terms of them, lots of tech managers, especially the folks who moved from being coders, being software engineers, that they desperately want to do this well because they lived a life before or even currently where what they do, they're doing it really well. That's why they got promoted, right? Because they wouldn't have gotten promoted for it. And so you get so used to, being the one that knows all and being the one who can humbly do this and produce results and it's tangible results. And then suddenly you're dealing with this loosey-goosey people stuff. And how do I do it? I want to be able to do it well, but I'm lost. It is a tricky thing to, I like the word that you use, to safely get them where they need to go, without making them feel bad about themselves. That's hard, because we have egos. Humans have egos, and they're very fragile.
I probably asked about 150 tech managers this question, and I've yet to have anybody respond. And I'll tell you the question. I've asked about 150 tech managers, how easy was the transition from programmer to manager for you?
Yeah.
Because I have in my mind that maybe it was easy for some people. I have literally never found someone who said, no brainer, easy as pie. I have instead heard horror stories about battlefield promotions, all kinds of terrible things where people are just dumped in the middle of technical leadership and expected to sink or swim. So I say that because I don't want any of your listeners to imagine, if you're listening to this, that you are unique or alone if you're finding this transition difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, I know that we all like to pretend that we're all precious little snowflakes that the tech industry is somehow different from other industries. There are similarities and differences. But when I've talked with other folks in other industries and other of my friends who are leadership coaches, more general leadership coaches who don't necessarily focus on tech, the same thing happens. Whatever industry you're talking about, that because it's such a huge shift from a more technical position to a more strategic position, that it required that you're going through an identity crisis. Yeah, actually, that's part of the process. It's part of the growth process, and that the only way that we get better is by suffering from, maybe suffering is a bad word, but by going through that little bit of discomfort, by going through that shift and sort of fumbling our way through, and that hopefully you have some help along the way to get there faster, to make it a little more bearable. But it's the nature of the thing. You're talking about a shift. It's a career change almost. Similar to, say, being an employee to owning your own business, which is something that I think we both can relate to, that it's very similar in that way, and that it's a long and winding road, but it can be very fun as well.
I think I kind of generalize it as the maker to manager transition, whether you're a designer, whether you're a coffee barista, and whatever it is that you're really good at, if you have to manage other people that are now doing that work, it's going to be hard. And it's hard for a lot of weird reasons that, at least for me, surprised me. I didn't think I would feel the sense of loss that I felt when I stopped coding. And it was really keen. And that was hard for me to deal with. And I suspect anybody who loves their craft is going to go through something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So on that note, Marcus, it is about time to wrap things up. It has been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the work that you're doing, Jen, and really excited to see how things unfold with the PeopleStack stuff that you're working on. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Thanks again, Marcus, and let's talk again soon.